Hi, and welcome to episode 95 of Fresh Out of Tokens. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher Tier. And today I'm talking with Ian Hamilton, who's amazing. And I had a chance to finally meet him in real life this year at the Game Accessibility Conference. So welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I'm so excited that I get a chance to chat with you, not once, like a year, but, you know, actually three times now, because I saw you at the conference and we did a stream for Game Accessibility, for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. So I'm excited to talk to you, especially on the heels of having Renee on the show, who also talked a bit about accessibility and her East Coast Games Conference talk on the same subject. Yeah, it was great because her talk focused on multiplayer accessibility. But before we get into questions, I wanted to just remind folks that we have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, where we split the profits 50-50 with Chachi Bobings, who designed our logo and header. There's a blog to compliment the show. Follow us over at outertokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, episode, or guest feedback, drop a note to freshoutoftokens@gmail.com. Keep up with guest announcements and show news over at outertokenscast. So with that out of the way, for the folks who don't know what you do, can you give a little bit of background? So who you are and what is it that you do in terms of accessibility?
Yep, sure. Well, I started out in design and gradually moved across to accessibility. So I'm now an accessibility specialist. And that means I kind of split my time between consulting work, so working together with studios and industry bodies and platforms and all that kind of stuff. And the rest of my time is spent on advocacy, so awareness raising, trying to educate people. Basically, that accessibility is a thing, why it matters, and just helping people to avoid unnecessary barriers that get in the way of the experience of people with disabilities.
Awesome. Well, I'm very glad that you're doing the work that you're doing because it's necessary. And, you know, it's one place where I've always had a failing in terms of being an advocate for diversity. So I'm glad that you're doing this work and keeping folks like me on our toes and making sure we think about it and not let it slip through the cracks. So the other question I always like to ask guests is, you know, what's your origin story? What got you into gaming?
Well, I started gaming in kind of mid-80s, so that ages me a bit. I had my first experiences playing other people's machines that they were able to bring into school. Then eventually the first one that I got myself was, again, this will age me, an Atari 800 XL, which was kind of like a 8-bit merger between like a tape computer and a console. And yes, I love that, but it wasn't really until my next machine, which was an Atari ST, which that's what really got me. Was by that stage, it was kind of the world building, you know, the improvements in the graphics and the sound, and even just things like the box art. That's what really got me. Some quite powerful experiences and worlds, which were quite an impact on a 10-year-old mind.
Oh, that's awesome! And you know, I think you're the first person to mention the box art being part of why they got into gaming. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, if you look at, in particular, some of the old Psygnosis and Cyclops games, things like Shadow of the Beast, you know, there's some quite stunning stuff back then.
Yeah. Wow, now I want to, like, go back and Google that stuff because I don't remember a lot of the box art from early games, mostly because I was a little kid, so.
Yeah, it was kind of it tipped over. The real early games, like the old Atari games and NES and stuff were fairly basic, but that's when they started getting some decent artists involved.
Yeah.
Quite nice science fiction and fantasy artwork on the covers.
True. So the main thing I wanted to talk about again with you was accessibility and advocacy. And I was wondering, you know, what made you think about this, you know, also as a full-time thing, because it is what you do full-time. So what got you on that path?
Well, I guess to answer that, you need to go back a little bit further, and because it was kind of a multi-step process, what got me interested in accessibility in general to start with. And that was when I was working on kids' games, and I saw some playtesting footage of some games that had been adapted to be controllable just using a single key press. The reason for that was that that signal key press can be mapped to something like, for example, blowing into a tube or a button mounted on a wheelchair headrest, all kinds of stuff. So I saw this playtesting footage of these kids in the schools using these games. And when I was at school myself, the school that I was at had a exchange program with a special education school. And I'd seen, you know, preschool kids with this kind of level of motor impairment who were basically just lying there being cared for, being passive participants in the classroom. And then through seeing this playtesting footage, through a relatively straightforward bit of technology and design consideration, these kids were laughing, smiling, playing, just doing the same thing as all their classmates. Now, which is quite a powerful thing to see. That's kind of what kicked it off. That kind of started me off on working on similar kind of projects myself. And then a little bit further on down the line, after my career progressed a bit and I was kind of overseeing lots of different games that are coming through from different companies, kind of like on a publisher basis, I started seeing the same kind of issues coming up across lots of different games. So, you know, studios which were trying so hard to put so much polish into some small aspect of the gameplay to make it a little bit better for, but at the same time, just through some really trivial, unnecessary design decision, like, for example, using red and green for their checkpoints, unintentionally making it a miserable experience for, you know, big swathes of their players. So that's kind of what got me into internal advocacy, just that frustration of seeing that there's something, such an unnecessary problem that needed fixing, you know. So that got me into kind of internal, within the company, internal advocacy and consulting within the teams and working on guidelines and stuff. Then as far as doing it in the wider industry goes, I got to the point where the company I was working for was moving to the other side of the country and I couldn't move with them. So I went to the biggest authority I could find on the subject at the time. That's a really nice organization in the UK called Special Effect. So I have a chat with them saying, you know, this is the aspect of my job that I now enjoy the most. What other companies could I go to and carry on in the same capacity? And they said, well, none. And that was quite a shock to me because, you know, I didn't just work in gaming. I also worked in web development as well. And in the web industry, being an accessibility specialist is just a standard career path. In other industries as well, you know, like construction, town planning. So it was a real shock to me that the games industry was so far behind. So that's what really got me into advocacy properly, because it stopped then being a search for, you know, a job that I enjoyed and then actually joining all those other people who are actually trying to make a difference in changing the industry. So that was the big stepping stone for me into that. So I've continued on doing that for a while. And it's got to the point now where there is enough demand from the consulting side of it that I can focus just on doing that.
That's awesome. And, you know, hopefully it will be a standard practice at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, even already that just recently there was a company called Household Games who are making a game called Way of the Passive Fist. It's headed up by one of the crew from Guacamele. And they're, you know, they're a small indie studio. I think they've got about 10 staff. And one of those staff is, you know, a permanent accessibility specialist. So I think things are changing quite quickly.
That's really cool. So aside from, you know, all the work that you're doing, I'm sure like any other person trying to advocate and get folks in the industry to listen, it's not always easy. So I was wondering, what has been the hardest or most difficult thing about getting folks to understand that accessibility is an issue and getting them to understand that it is important?
Well, there's a kind of a common set of misconceptions, and to be honest, I had most of them myself because, you know, I wasn't born caring about game accessibility. And it's the accessibility has to be difficult and expensive, that it's going to be diluting down your ideas to suit a tiny minority, and that minority probably doesn't even play games anyway. You know, all those kind of misconceptions, which so many people quite naturally have, but, you know, each one of those is demonstrably false. So it's just a case of educating people. And there's a bit of a divide in the industry as well. So, I mean, if you are talking about individual developer level, and especially indie developers, then it's more the barriers people have in their heads of thinking that it's going to be really time consuming and expensive, which is obviously going to put you off if you've got low resources. the other end of the industry, if you're talking about AAA publishers, it's a different kind of thing. It's more about the business case. Is this going to be a return on the investment compared to the 8,000 other features I've got in my backlog? You know? But all of it comes down to the same thing, which is, you know, like I said, it is all demonstrably false. So it's just a case of awareness raising, having those conversations. And you know, that's something that anyone at all can get involved with.
Okay. Well, that's good because like you said, a lot of people probably just assume that if they start really thinking about accessibility, it'll blow their budget, or the erroneous assumption that, you know, people with disabilities don't play games at all, which isn't true.
Absolutely. All those things. And especially with the thing with the budget, the big, big thing with the budget is just the stage of development that you think about it at. So there is stuff that's going to be difficult and expensive, but most of it really isn't. And some of it can even be free as well. So a classic example being text size. Text size mm-hmm. is really, really, really common accessibility complaint in games. If you try to go back and retrofit different text size into your game, it's really difficult, really expensive, usually prohibitively so. You just can't do it. But if you think about that from the start, if you just say from the start of development, I'm not going to use beneath 28 pixels text size, that's nothing. You know, that doesn't cost anything. That's just a design decision. It's free. The only cost is then actually acquiring the knowledge to know about that.
Very true. Yeah, because we were chatting before about like how there was a change in text size in Mass Effect Andromeda after release. And I think you were saying that you couldn't really tell the difference.
Yeah, there is a slight difference, but it's kind of limited. It's the same kind of thing with Witcher 3. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about Witcher 3. The fact they even did it is amazing. They straight after launch, you know, within the first month or so, they patched a whole load of accessibility things, colorblind mode, remappable controls, text size. But you are kind of limited because you've already designed all the containers to be a certain size. You might have text that's rendered as images that you'd have to remake. And that's a lot of going back and unpicking to change that when, you know, if you think about that from the outset, you could just have designed it in a good way to begin with.
Yeah. You know, as we're recording this, E3 is happening next week. And, you know, we're seeing more conversations about accessibility and the people thinking about it. So I was wondering, do you think we'll even hear anything out of E3 about accessibility, or have you ever seen it discussed at major events like that?
Well, I certainly hope so. Last year, Microsoft announced their Gaming for Everyone initiative, which explicitly includes accessibility. And mm-hmm. that was quite a big stepping stone to have the, you know, the top bods at Xbox making public commitments to accessibility at something like E3. So there is now precedent. Sony side, the effort that they went to publicize all the good work that went into Uncharted, more and more games are starting to talk about accessibility in usually not so much a big deal in kind of like trailers and stuff, but at least it's starting to appear in things like press releases and feature lists. So I'm certainly hopeful. I don't want to say I think there will be, but I hope there would be.
Okay.
And there's certainly no shortage of people doing good things that they could potentially talk about.
Yeah, because I knew very little about the intentional accessibility built in Uncharted, for instance, until I went to GAConf.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there. I mean, it's not perfect by any means. I don't think really any game is at the moment, but it's made a very, very good start. And like was covered at the conference, I mean, the kind of stuff they were doing in Uncharted, that was, you know, a small number of people doing something quite late in development. So what I'm really interested to see is what's going to happen with their next game now that it's on the radar.
Yeah, well, we can you know, hope and you know, kind of make them accountable if it's not the same thing whenever a new Uncharted game comes out, if it happens. But speaking of GA conference or Game Accessibility Conference, you and Tara started it, and I was wondering, how has the reception been? Because, you know, it is a conference focusing on one aspect of development and diversity. And as we both know, sometimes people are not as receptive as they could be to discussions about topics that are not, you know, strictly about graphics or what have you.
The reception has been well, it took our breath away a bit, really, because it came about really because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about accessibility at conferences, but it's usually just kind of one talk gets onto the bill, and it's usually kind of awareness raising kind of thing. And it felt like we're really at the stage where we should be beyond that. There's people doing different interesting things in different areas. You should be able to easily get together a program for a full day that goes into a few more deep dives on specific features, specific case studies, techniques, politics, all that kind of stuff. So that's what we did. It also allowed us to do some other things as well, like ensuring that all the talks were on the same day in the same room, so that we can make some choices about accessibility of the venue that aren't possible at other conferences. So there's a few different reasons we did it. But the reception has been really good. The thing that was really, really surprising, I think to both of us and the other people involved in running it as well, was the demographics involved. So it was a really, really heavy AAA turnout, which isn't really the case when there's been accessibility talks at other events. You know, they occasionally get a couple of AAA people in the room, but this was a lot of people from the big companies there and in quite senior positions as well, which was very, very encouraging to see. The individual feedback as well was quite touching, some of the things that people said about the event. And the decision's kind of been taken out of our hands. The idea was just to try it and see what happens. But by the end of the day, the attendees were already talking about next year's event as if it was a given. So they kind of made the decision for us.
Well, I'm very happy, and I hope that you do have another one next year, and I will definitely be there. But speaking of which, you know, since you've gotten all this great feedback and people are kind of expecting / wanting a GAConf next year, are there things that you didn't get to cover in this first event that you would love to touch on for next year?
Well, I think there's some things that we definitely would want to keep the same. There's things like the general format of the event and the times and stuff we had lots of good feedback on. But one thing that would be nice, I think, would be the indie coverage was a panel which was largely kind of a high-level discussion. I think it'd be really nice to get some good indie case studies on the go. I mean, even if it's one, just to help dispel the idea that that accessibility is difficult, and show that actually even with a small team, with a small budget, there's a load of really nice stuff you could do. Also as well, we did have a little bit of a mention about people with difficulty reading, but as always, whether it's game development or any other industry at all, I'm always very, very keen for representation of cognitive accessibility. Because unlike, you know, there's, I think it's, is it 14%? Yeah, I think, can't remember, it's 14 or 16% of the adult population in the USA has difficulty reading. And that's only one area of cognitive accessibility. But you don't really hear about it because there's such a big stigma. So despite the barriers it can present, you don't really get people talking about encountering those barriers to the same extent that you might have, for example, if someone's blind, if someone's deaf. They're much more comfortable talking about barriers they encounter, so they don't have the same stigma. So any chance at all for representation of cognitive accessibility, I'm always very, very keen on.
Okay. I know we talked a bit before about getting people to understand why accessibility is important. But I was thinking more on the development end, you know, aside from budget and aside from other things we talked about, just overall getting people to understand the importance of it. Were there any challenges you've gotten as you've done more of this work, as you become a full-time advocate and you're known for this work? Are there challenges that you see trying to just kind of get in the door and talk to people about this?
To be honest, it's a lot easier in game development than it is in other industries, because you get so many more people who are in game development for the right reasons. You know, if people were in it just for some interesting problem solving or for the monetary aspect, you know, you'd be off working in a bank or something. You know, people are in game development because they really care about games, regardless of what discipline they're in. They care about the vision they're working so hard on, reaching the public and people enjoying that and experiencing it. So once you start having the conversations about accessibility on, you know, an individual person level, it's usually a pretty easy sell. It's more a case of people actually having the misconceptions and just having those conversations and letting people know that actually the things that they're worrying about aren't, you know, things that need to be worried about. I suppose it's more of an issue really when you're speaking to individual developers, particularly at big studios, who then have a difficult time getting it past other people in the company. So it's one thing if you're working in an indie studio, you decide you care about accessibility, you make some changes in the game, it's done. You don't have to, you know, stick it through a massive backlog, compete against loads of other features that has to go through several layers of management to get approval to make it on there. So that's where I think the challenge is in not just in educating individual people, but also empowering them to have those kind of discussions with other people in their company as well.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense, because a lot of times people, I think that's the one thing people don't think about, and I'm talking now about consumers, where they think either features are super easy to implement. You know, when you see people going, oh, just add multiplayer, add this ginormous feature that, you know, would in reality take months, if not year or more, of development time and coding, and they think it can be done in a couple weeks since the game is already made.
Yeah, and it's usually find that it's the other way around as well, completely. So the things that people without development experience assume will be really difficult are really easy, and the things that they assume really easy are going to be really difficult. So classic one being, like I was saying about text size, I see that all the time. Gamers saying, you know, just let us change all the size in the game, change all the text size in the game. That'd be easy. You could do that in a day. Yes, not really the case.
You're like, no, no, not actually. That's actually quite a bit of work. So let's flip it a bit. What's been the easiest time that you've had convincing someone, you know, either they listened and you were surprised they listened, or just you talked about it and they were surprisingly receptive?
Well, a lot of the time it is just easy. I'm going to steal somebody else's story for this. Tara, who was the co-director on the Game Accessibility Conference, she was working at Turtle Rock on Evolve, and she was building her case for making a load of accessibility changes when they were coming up for implementing Stage 2. And so she went into the meeting to give a presentation and kind of started the speech saying, you know, that this is accessibility, this is why it's important. And then he said, yep, sure, great, we're doing it. And then she's like, well, but, you know, I've made a PowerPoint and everything. yeah, you see that a lot when people just, you know, like I was saying, it just fits with the way that people working in the games industry think. They want people to be enjoying their games, and the idea of somebody having an unnecessarily miserable experience with her game goes against what game development's all about. So it can be quite easy. I suppose probably more interesting it'd be when people have come around from not being interested to being interested. The thing I've actually had the most success with for that is a app on my phone, which is a colorblindness simulator. And you can get that for any smartphone. Just search in the App Store for colorblind simulator, and you get real-time ones, which basically it just applies filters to what your camera on your phone is looking at. So you can get a rough approximation in real time of what it looks like to see through colorblind eyes. And I've had that a lot of times when I've been speaking to people about it, and, you know, can you kind of see their eyes glazing over a bit, and they're not really interested and can't really see how it relates to them. But then get the app out, because that's the thing with colorblindness. It's something that a lot of people are aware about, but not really very many people have got a clear picture in their head of what your vision actually looks like if you're colorblind. Mm-hmm. The people are really interested in that, and you can just see people looking around, looking through this app, going, oh, that's really interesting. Oh, and in my game, yeah, I've got this thing based on color. I can see that if I just change this, and, you know, it gets people thinking. You can kind of see the light bulb pinging on above their heads.
Nice. If you get a chance, please give us a link to the app and what it is, so then I can make sure to have that in show notes so people want to go check out that app.
Yep, shall do.
So I guess to wind down, just a couple more questions, is I guess, what do you think it'll take? Because it seems like some people are already super on board with accessibility for whatever reason, and they know it's important. And then there's always people that you have to convince, you know, just like with any other aspect of diversity and thinking about your player base as beyond the quote unquote assumed audience. What do you think it'll take for developers to think about this at day zero versus the game has come out and someone says, I can't read this tiny text on your screen, or I can't hear what's going on, or I'm colorblind and I can't play your game?
Well, working backwards, to get people to start thinking about it from the outset of game development, it's never going to happen from the off. It needs to be as a result of a previous game you've worked on. You know, if you've worked on a game and got to the end of development, gone back and tried to retrofit some things, you'll have it stuck in your head that, oh my God, if only I'd worked on this earlier, there'd be more things I could do. And that means that when you go to work in the next game, you're in a position to think about those things from the start. But to make that first step of actually first thinking about putting something in your game, I think the thing that makes a really, really big difference is having some big name examples. And we've already seen that happen with colorblindness. As you know, it's pretty much a given thing now that people consider colorblindness in game development. But it's actually only a very recent thing. You know, that it was going back to 2014, there was a couple of really big name, high profile games that started considering colorblindness, which was, I think it was Black Ops 2, SimCity, Borderlands 2. Until then, it really wasn't a big consideration. It just took those first few big games to be thinking about it to generate media interest. There are a lot of big stories on the games press about those games. You know, in those days, it was front page news that a game considered colorblindness. Whereas now it's completely the other way around. There was last year, 2016, when The Witness came out, there was an editorial piece written by a games journalist who wrote an entire piece just to apologize for failing to point out that The Witness wasn't colorblind friendly. So that's a really astonishing turnaround in the industry in the space of 2 years. It just goes to show what can happen when you do get a couple of, you know, high profile examples. And you can see that happening again now with the work that was done on Uncharted for motor accessibility. Because they made quite an effort to talk to people about it, and it got picked up a lot in the press, and other developers are picking up on it. And I've seen people ranging all the way from a one-man indie to decent-sized publishers who have been strongly influenced by that. They've even heard it referred to within the publisher as the Uncharted effect for the degree of the impact that it's had. So I think it's just a snowball effect. You know, the more examples you get, the more people you get implementing it, they will then push the bar a bit further, implementing different things. Other people learn from them. So it's only just going to keep accelerating and accelerating, and in a positive direction.
Awesome. Okay, so last question before we get into our couple of listener questions. So in an ideal world, let's say that developers start thinking about this from day zero, or they, you know, work on a game and start thinking about it in their next game from day zero. What do you think a truly accessible game would look like if developers are considering this from the beginning?
Well, I think the really, really important thing to keep in mind is just to be realistic about it, because for a game to even meet the definition of being a game, there needs to be some kind of a challenge involved.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of a challenge is going to be an impassable barrier for someone. So it's important to realize that it's not about making a game accessible to everyone. It's about making a game that avoids unnecessary barriers. Because if you got rid of all the barriers, it wouldn't be a game. It would just be an interactive narrative, or it would be a toy, you know? So that's it, just being realistic about it. It's you're never going to get games that are accessible to everyone. What you want, though, is games that are inaccessible for the right reasons, you know? So you're not unnecessarily locking people out. So if you've got a deaf person really isn't going to be annoyed that they can't play a music quiz, but they are going to be annoyed when you don't subtitle your cinematics. It's that kind of thing. So that's the point we really need to get to, where it's considered early enough and thoroughly enough that no one is unnecessarily excluded.
Okay. That's interesting, because that's not what I was thinking when I wrote the question. I was thinking more in terms of like games that people can play with the usual mechanics. You know, that would still present a challenge, but just making it so other people can play.
Yep. Yeah, that's what it's about. It's about taking that experience, identifying what makes the game fun, and opening that fun up to as many people as possible. And that's kind of the point that I was getting at, though, that the part of what makes the game fun is going to be, for some people, exclusionary. You just want to make sure that nobody else is excluded from that.
Okay. Awesome. You've given me food for thought.
Good stuff.
And so the obvious question is, aside from kind of being not so subtly nudged about GA Conference next year, what is next for you? What's coming up?
More of the same. So I've got some work going on. I can't really talk about the things that I'm doing with companies. but some interesting things that companies are doing internally. There's a lot of stuff that needs to still happen in the industry in general. It's still really early days. One thing that I'd really love to see more on is accessibility in funding programs. That's something that has been really, really successful. There's a funding body in Australia called Film Victoria, who has government funding. They give developers money to help develop their games. And when applying for this funding, there's a section on the application form basically which says, here's a few common accessibility considerations. Tick the ones you're considering. Here's another box to tell us about anything else you're doing. Here's another box. If you're not considering accessibility, tell us why not. And in the 4 years that's been running, there hasn't been a single person who has written anything in that box. So it's a really, really powerful way to raise awareness. And yes, yeah, so in those 4 years, there hasn't been a single person who hasn't written something in the accessibility box, which is quite mind-blowing compared to the general level of the industry. And that started to spread to a couple of places. Creative Europe does it. Screen Australia did it briefly. And yeah, there's a couple of other funding bodies that are potentially interested. So that's something that I'm putting a fair bit of time into advocating for that. Also, middleware engines. Engines would be an area that'd be really, really nice to see some progress in. Because at the moment, engines are a bit of an accessibility barrier. They get a bit in the way of people trying to do accessibility in their games when really they could be the opposite. They could be a huge enabler, you know, doing some of the heavy lifting, offering some tools like things like color blindness simulation, for example, to help people do accessibility stuff, exposing their interfaces in the right way so that people who are blind can use their own software to have the label spoken up. Lots of really, really cool stuff that engines could do. So, yeah, that's something else that I do a lot of work in. We'll be busy with that.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to hearing what you've worked on once you can talk about it.
What I will say is it's just exciting times. You know, there's people doing things now that would have just been unimaginable a couple of years ago, whether it's that stuff at game developer level, publisher level, industry body level, platform level. It's all happening.
Cool. Well, when you can talk about them, you're always welcome to come back on the show and discuss them. And so just a couple questions from our listeners. Loyal friend of the show, Tim Poedante. He wanted to know two things. The first question was, what games, if any, would you point out as exemplars of how to do accessibility?
That's a slightly tricky question to ask, because I wouldn't say there is any one game that does a fantastic job of being accessible to as many people as it could do. So it's still relatively early days. There's a lot of studios who are doing individual things really nicely. There's growing numbers of studios who are doing multiple things really nicely. A couple of my favorites recently have been Rocket League. Rocket League does all kinds of nice stuff. It has a whole bunch of nice things for motor accessibility, from remapping to sensitivity to simplified controls. It has largely colorblind friendly by default color schemes and the option to lock the team colors in as well. It has really nice stuff for communication as well. That's something that's often overlooked in accessibility, but is starting to become less so because there's some legal facts involved in the US. But people who have difficulty speaking and hearing, who obviously have difficulty participating in games that rely on voice chat. And Rocket League has a choice of three different methods of communication that are all compatible with each other. So you can speak via voice, you can speak via free text, and you can speak via configurable predefined phrases. And that works across console and PC. So that's a really nice example. Two recent games, Injustice and it's not Injustice. MKX, actually Injustice did have it as well, and also Killer Instinct. They actually have dedicated developer effort to blind accessibility. So in Killer Instinct, this is just by default. In Injustice and Mortal Kombat, there's actually a mode that you turn on. They're basically ensuring that all of the sounds in the game are distinct. And in the case of Mortal Kombat, it adds in additional audio cues to let you know when you are standing in front of an interactive background element. Killer Instinct also adds in an extra audio slider for UI sounds, so you can turn the volume all the way up for when things like power meters are charged. Basically, all these things add up to the gameplay being completely accessible for people who are completely blind. There's basically the mechanic as well suited to it. All you need to do is be able to hear in stereo space where two objects are and what they're doing, and every single sound is unique, so you can do that. And you actually have tournament-level fighting game players as a result of how accessible fighting games are to people who are blind. And that's been really nice. That's something you haven't had before, to have, you know, multiple like big AAA games on consoles that are blind accessible. And there's new functionality coming out that's going to allow menus to be navigable in console games by people who are blind. So that's going to be an area that there's hopefully going to be even more growth in. But yeah, that's just a couple of examples. There's many, many more. If you have a look on a site called gameaccessibilityguidelines.com, there is a list of good practices on there, and the majority of on there of those good practices have examples of games that are already doing a good job on them. So there's lots of good material in there for that.
Awesome. And we actually kind of covered his next question in our general conversation, but did you have anything to add on to his question about, are you seeing more studios take accessibility more seriously than they have in the past?
Well, the answer, well, yeah, from our conversation already, the answer to that is just an emphatic yes. However, it is still nowhere near the number of studios that need to be thinking about it, and it's still nowhere near to the degree that it could be thought about as well. So there's still a lot of work that could be done. And as I was saying, that's work that anyone who's listening to this can get involved in. Just keeping the conversation going, you know. People who haven't considered accessibility before, you need to start thinking about it. People who have started thinking about it, we just need to keep thinking about it, to not let it slide, not forget that this kind of stuff is important. So I think that would be the key message, that regardless of whether you're in the industry or not, whether you're a gamer, whether you're a developer, just keep that conversation going. Keep talking about accessibility, that it exists, why it's important, and we can't fail to get to a good place.
Very true. And that's one thing that I'm grateful for you, for like Renee, Able Gamers, and people are talking about it, because again, a lot of people who talk about diversity don't consider accessibility as part of that spectrum of discussion.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's an underrepresented and excluded minority group, and a big one. So it absolutely needs to be part of those diversity discussions, I agree.
Yeah, so, you know, just giving you effusive praise for the work that you do, and I'm very glad that you exist and are doing this work in the industry, because it's needed.
Well, pleasure, thank you. Yeah, and with everyone else who's working in it, I think everyone who's working it is doing it for exactly that reason, just because it's something that needs to be done.
Yeah. So speaking of fighting games, this actually segues into kind of our last little discussion tidbit, and as you know, we like to end the show talking about what we're playing, reading, watching these days. And since you are the guest, what have you been playing and reading?
I've been playing Thimbleweed Park, and I have been reading With Blood Upon the Sand.
And what is Thimbleweed Park about? Because I've not actually heard of that game.
Thimbleweed Park is a old school point and click adventure game. That's been built by some of the greats who are behind all the old classics like Day of the Tentacle and Manic Mansion, that kind of stuff. And it's done in a throwback kind of style to those games as well, all the old inventory-driven puzzles and multiple characters, all that kind of stuff. If you liked any of those old games, I would highly, highly recommend checking it out.
Cool. And as for me, I've actually been playing Injustice 2. I've been playing a bit of Tekken 7, but it's been difficult because the online matching is not working right now. So been playing it very slowly, getting through the story mode, and then hoping to get some online matches with folks. I actually fired up The Sims 4 the other day, because why not? It's The Sims. And I am a weak, weak person, and there was a sale, so I bought some of the new packs that came out. But it's been interesting revisiting The Sims and all the stuff you can do in there.
Well, next time we play Injustice 2, have a look in the settings. You'll find accessibility mode in there. Then you can have a listen in the gameplay for the extra audio cues that adds in to let you know about the interactive elements and that kind of thing. And actually, cool. that's a nice illustration of something we were talking about earlier before, because for Mortal Kombat X, accessibility mode was a patch that came in after release. in Injustice 2, it was already there in beta.
Nice. Yeah, I will have to go back and do that because I'm through the story mode in Injustice, but I've done a lot of the other stuff. So maybe I'll do that next time I stream it so we can all check out the accessibility options in Injustice 2.
Yeah, indeed. Fantastic.
Yeah, so sadly, that is the end of our time together for this episode. But for folks who want to learn more about your work and learn more about you, where can they find you online?
The best place to reach me is on Twitter at @IanHamilton_. There's also a personal site, which I have a blog on. The rest of the site's down at the moment, but you can still have a poke around in the blog. That is ian-hamilton.com. If you want to know more about the conference, that is at gaconf.com. And almost all of the talks from the conference are available freely online as well. So if you search for GAConf 2017 on YouTube, you should be able to get a playlist up of all the content from that as well. Then also the website I was talking about earlier with the accessibility guidelines and examples of best practices on is at gameaccessibilityguidelines.com.
Awesome. And listeners, we will have a link to that playlist as well. So thank you so much for hanging out with me and spending some time for your afternoon, my morning. And I'm very, very glad for you. And, you know, anytime you want to come back and talk about accessibility, you're always welcome on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
You're welcome. And hopefully I will get to see you in person sooner than next year, but definitely next year at whatever shape the conference takes place or GDC.
Yep, indeed.
All right. So thank you, folks, for listening, and we'll see you in a week. Bye.